Here we are in a cultural moment that dizzies with outrageousness. Politics, Me Too, espionage, and the quest for justice. We experience reality as fiction and seek heroes to rescue us from it. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea. From James Comey to Brett Kavanaugh, the FBI has been front and center in our sight, as has gender politics and sexual harassment. This all converges in Barbara Vandriel's memoir of her time as an FBI agent, It Never Happened, FBI Negligence and Duplicity from the Inside Out. Her eye-opening book reveals the good old boys of the FBI and their treatment of female agents during the wave of gender integration in the 1980s and 90s. We'll talk with Vandriel later in this show. Coming right up is my conversation with best-selling author Andrew Schaefer. In just a few short years, we have gone from the transformative event of our first African-American president and the vision of his administration to the frightening buffoonery of the Trump administration. We need some superheroes, and Schaefer brings them to us in Hope Never Dies, an Obama-Biden mystery. Yes, Barack Obama and Joe Biden are back, but this time tracking down a killer in this piece of humorous crime fiction. Andrew Schaefer is the author of several humorous works of fiction and nonfiction, including 50 Shames of Earl Grey. I spoke with him from Kentucky, where he makes his home. Andrew Schaefer, Hope Never Dies. First of all, welcome here remotely to Northern California.
Thanks for having me. It's probably a lot warmer there than where I'm at in Kentucky.
It's probably just a little warmer. I think the seasons are changing everywhere. And your book, Hope Never Dies, that you released earlier in the year, it's kind of like a Mobius strip of reality in a way. Here we have a president who is out of reality television and leaving many, many people in the country longing for heroes of Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And you have presented us now a fiction, a kind of comedic noir Obama-Biden mystery that brings these two beloved people into a new light and a new setting. And what motivated you or inspired you to go in this direction?
Well, yeah, it's a little bit of what you're saying is that I thought people sort of needed, heroes. And after, I think, the 2016 election, there were a lot of people that felt sort of dejected by, what was going on in the country, myself included, and saw it going in a very different direction. And we said, where did the last president and vice president go off to? And we knew that they weren't going to be front and center until probably at least the midterms, which proved to be true. But at the time, I think there were a lot of Obama Biden memes going around on the internet where people were just saying, "Oh, we just didn't know what we had with these two," and you really wanted sort of a steady, hand there in government. You didn't realize how important that was for a lot of people. I think for everybody, just seemed that with the new administration, every day was some new crisis that was happening. So, I really wanted to bring them back, but as characters, almost to the point where they're sort of like superheroes, but they're amateur detectives in the book.
And they are superheroes in a certain sort of way. And Joe Biden is the narrator, and he's, I want to call him a hard-boiled voice in the book, but he's more soft-boiled in a way that he has, he has this colloquial vernacular that is so uniquely his, and we right away feel like we we know Joe, and then cool, collected, always having the right approach. Barack Obama appears literally in a cloud of smoke. But both of these characters you've put into, you know, a kind of a, I'm going to call it comedic noir, you know, you use a crime fiction, but we recognize them. And so that must have been kind of fun for you, but also a delicate process to make these characters not caricatures, somebody we recognize.
Yeah, it wasn't easy at first getting the tone right, because if I made them as, you know, realistic as possible, you know, Joe Biden is not as, you know, sort of folksy as I make him out to be. That's sort of the public image of Joe Biden, of Amtrak Joe, man of the people. But, you know, if you read books about him behind the scenes, he's very intelligent, thoughtful. He, you know, can stand his own against Barack Obama, who's also seen as, you know, very intelligent and thoughtful. But Joe just has these moments where he sort of reverts into his sort of folksy self, and I just wanted that folksy voice to be there throughout the book. So it was definitely a fine line between saying, you know, how much of their real personalities do I bring into the book, and how much you know, is sort of a caricature of them. And in fact, it ended up being that I got so attached to this Joe Biden that I had created that when I actually met him last week in Kentucky, and I was like, "You're not the guy. You're not the same guy."
So you got to meet Joe Biden. Does he know about your book?
Oh yeah. He had known about it, and his some people that had worked for him were fans of the book, and so I don't know if he's read it per se, but. He was definitely aware of it, and he signed a copy for me. But it was very surreal, you know. It was almost like seeing a character that I'd written about, you know, come to life. And then I go, oh, wait a minute, no, I that character in my book was based on Joe Biden, and now, you know, Joe Biden's got a copy of my book here. It was all very surreal, and you know, he was very very serious in person, because he's. You know, got a very serious task right now, which is to motivate people to go out and vote in the midterms, and he's, you know, contemplating another run for president. So he's definitely got a lot on his mind.
In your book as well, he does not rule out. He leaves the door open for running for president.
Yeah. I didn't know what was going to happen, you know, last year when I wrote the book. It was just like he could run, he might not run, but regardless, I thought that, you know, he would still be on people's minds.
And it's a good read. It's not like completely reading a Mad Magazine version of these two guys. It's if you like crime books, you'll probably like this one too. But there is really chuckles on every page, and laugh out loud lines. And I just can imagine that you yourself had a lot of fun putting the story together.
Oh, of course. It was a little difficult to try to get that tone right, though, because you have to balance out, you know, a real sort of, there's a murder mystery in the background of an Amtrak conductor, and so you have to deal with some weighty subjects, and also balance it out with humor. And, you know, the writers that I thought about while working on it were like Elmore Leonard, Lawrence Block, Donald Westlake, some of these sort of classic comedic crime writers that I was a fan of growing up, and who really balanced that sort of that craziness and the humor with serious crime and stuff. So that's where that sort of came from. But yeah, no, it was a lot of fun to research and write.
And you do have just a little bit of, I'm going to say, political reflection every now and then. You know, Joe reflects on things they didn't quite get done, or they didn't get done right. But there's not a lot of that, but especially because there's kind of this drug thread that runs through the book too. So that humanizes him or makes him more real to us.
Yeah, it's such a fine line to walk, but I had a great editor at Quirk Books who really helped me sort of toe that line of balancing the funny stuff with the serious stuff. And I think that makes the funny stuff really pop off the page a little more, because if it was just a laugh every 10 seconds throughout the whole book, you wouldn't be, I think, as interested in them as characters. And when we talk about the political stuff, there's not as much political stuff, I think, as people would imagine, because I wrote the book a little bit as escapism. It's, hey, for a couple of hours you can read this book and you're not going to have to think about what's going on, in the political landscape today. You can just kind of hang out with a couple of old friends and remember the good times. So there is a little bit of an escapist quality to it.
And the book opens up with Joe Biden reflecting on his, he misses his relationship with Barack, and that they were such good buds, and now he sees Barack off hang gliding and hanging out with Bradley Cooper, is so much in front of us these days. So I thought it was really kind of fun to have Joe a little bit jealous of Bradley Cooper. But
I mean, who isn't jealous of Bradley Cooper? That hair, those eyes. And now he's directing. I can't wait to see what Joe says in the next book now about Bradley Cooper.
So it looks like you might have a follow-up to this, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Working on it right now. It's called Hope Rides Again. It comes out next summer. And it's definitely the same tone and everything, although it takes place in Chicago and it deals with some topics that are closer, I think, to Barack Obama's heart than Joe's, but it's still told from Joe Biden's point of view, because I just thought that, worked so hard to capture that voice that I wanted to continue with that.
Well, we'll look forward to that. And I have to say that the cover of Hope Never Dies is really just really fabulous. I was reading the book on an airplane and somebody sitting next to me wanted to take a picture of the cover of the book. So I hope he subsequently picked up a copy of it too.
Oh yeah. The cover with the, it looks a little bit like George Washington crossing the Delaware or something. This fabulous painting, I think that was based on a Hardy Boys cover. But with Barack Obama and Joe Biden in a Pontiac Trans Am, which I should say doesn't appear in the actual book, but the art was so great, we were like, we got to use that. So I do have them in a Pontiac Trans Am in the second book, though. That will be on the way, but who knows what we're going to use for the cover for book two.
Well, you have a lot to live up to there, because it's a great cover. But cars, I'll say muscle cars, do play a part in the book. Both Barack Joe have their own new car acquisitions that feature in the book. Well, I just want to thank you for talking with us, and I thought that it would be good to bring this book back into our awareness, and maybe we need some superheroes, and hopefully people will get out and vote some of them into office.
yeah. Looking forward to it. It's going to be an interesting couple of weeks here, so I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, and we'll look forward to the sequel to Hope Never Dies. I've been talking with Andrew Schaefer. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Andrew Schaefer, and his book is Hope Never Dies, an Obama-Biden mystery. We'll take a short break before talking with Barbara Van Driel about real crime fighters and her years as an FBI agent. I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. ¶¶ The FBI is a federal institution that holds a marked place in our society and culture as the force that drills into crime, vets public appointees, and more recently affects the course of political outcomes. From its inception, the Bureau has been a male-dominated institution, and women had to be tough and focused to make it. Barbara Van Driel was a top student who just wanted to serve her fellow citizens. Through hard work, she succeeded in her goal to become an FBI agent. However, she didn't anticipate the complacency of career agents and the harassment she and other female agents would be subjected to in the course of their work. It never happened. FBI negligence and duplicity from the inside out is Van Driel's sometimes funny, sometimes shocking, and always revealing memoir of her years in the FBI. Let's listen to our conversation. Barbara Van Driel, it never happened. FBI negligence and duplicity revealed from the inside out. This is your new memoir. And so timely, really, when you think about the Me Too movement on one side, and you think about how much the FBI is in the news these days and integrated in with our politics. And now we have your memoir. In fact, you begin your memoir, I believe, the very first sentence, "I was born an FBI agent." So why don't we start there, that you had a career in the FBI, and how did you get going in that direction?
Thank you so much, Suzanne. Well, I opted to transfer to a university in Kansas, and I had a wonderful mentor, one of my college professors, whom I do mention in the introduction. We call him Louie Lee. And he saw in me the potential. I had dreamed about it, but it was one of those things that I was rather, I didn't discuss it too much. It seemed for a girl from New Jersey, from an Italian home, you know what I mean, from the time when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, a little out of reach. But he recommended that to me, and I decided to go and put my name on a list for the career day. And so in the fall of my senior year, I signed up for the 30-minute appointment, and I met the recruiter out of the Kansas City Division. So that's how it began.
As you allude, as a kid, it seems like somebody, maybe your cousin or somebody, asked you, mm-hmm. well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you, in fact, said, an FBI agent.
I did, Suzanne, yes. This cousin reminded me of this just a few years ago. I was rather taken aback because I was only 7. He was 15, and he remembered it very clearly. His family had come over for a visit, and he said, that's what I said.
Then it materialized, and you became an FBI agent at a time when, you know, kind of after the first wave of feminism, when a lot of the typically male-dominated institutions and law enforcement institutions were beginning to become integrated both racially and with gender. Mm-hmm. And this, men weren't quite ready for this, were they?
They were not, especially, I would say, uniquely the FBI community. There are many things, Suzanne, I don't put in the book because there would be so much. It'd almost be a 1,000-page memoir to go back to history and the particular culture. But I'll just anecdotally tell you that prior to the introduction of women, men agents used to sit at their desk and have a personal secretary come and take dictation for their reports. So they were very spoiled, I guess you could say. And then slowly, that system went by the wayside. And yes, it was very difficult. You probably remember a couple of incidents where I describe it at Quantico, but it was always a hostile environment for us in the years that I was there.
And your book is a memoir, but it does read like a novel almost. And we're used to seeing references to Quantico, for instance, in our popular culture. I think it's hard not to think of Jodie Foster running around in Silence of the Lambs. And how accurate is some of our pop culture representations of the FBI?
I've often said that much like I make the comparison to marriage, unless you've been in the FBI, it's a very difficult thing to understand. And if you don't mind, I can mention to you that during the filming of Silence of the Lambs, I was in the Bureau and I was back at Quantico right after they had wrapped up the shoot. So some of the students included in the background were still there. And the Bureau, I recall being told by an administrator, was unhappy because they insisted that Jodie be whisked away from Quantico to go on that case. And that was very inaccurate. That could never happen to a trainee. You must graduate. And the first day on your job, you could get a top 10 case. That would be probably the category there, a top 10. So I don't think that I've ever seen a film that really captures what the FBI is like.
We'll springboard off of Jodie Foster then, because it seems that the training that you went through, rigorous physical training, but that there seemed to be a rather detailed journey person's process of training and spending time in different divisions, maybe. And a very structured apprenticeship before you maybe take things on yourself. And it was in this process that you, in fact, were exposed to how men treated women because of the way they treated you. And maybe talk a little bit about that.
Well, interestingly, the training at Quantico, which I describe as academic firearms and physical fitness, is an interesting preparation, because day one on the job, none of the things that you've covered in the 4 months, which was how it was when I was there, really applies to being an agent on the job. And your cases are assigned, and day one you can get any kind of a case. But it's true, you have a form of apprenticeship for 1 to 2 months, but you're a fully functioning agent from day one. You've now become a full-time agent, and there's really no excuse-making for you. You need to be able to handle your cases.
And you seemed to be able to, in fact.
I was.
And it seemed like you took a lot of pride in the way you approached the work and in the way you documented things and the rigor that you approached investigating. But you rapidly discovered that your ethic was different from some of your colleagues.
Yes, I did. And that was, the part that was very hidden from me. I had a wonderful experience with the recruiter. I hope that comes across. All along the way, I was nurtured by that individual. He was a stellar individual. But it didn't prepare me for what I experienced, as you, I don't want to necessarily give anything away, but you see my first day on the job, what happens, what I write about. And thereafter, a lot of criticism, sometimes very subtle and sometimes direct. I don't know. Some people have said to me it was a form of jealousy because I refused to capitulate to some of the games that people played. Again, when you deal in an organization where they tell you continually, oh, we're the premier, we're the number one in law enforcement, you're just going to be surrounded by people, many people, who are very arrogant. They're very prideful. And that, I wasn't prepared for that, frankly. I really wasn't.
And it sounds like you also were not prepared for the working with people who didn't have the same standard as you with regard to productivity, with regard to detailing the results of your interviews or whatever. And How surprising that must have been.
Very surprising, because many of the background investigations, you were investigating people going to work in the White House. The Bureau has many responsibilities at the federal level to do these background investigations in very important positions. A lot of that, Suzanne, I actually didn't chronicle in the book because, frankly, I'll be honest with you, I became concerned the Bureau had to vet my book. And I became concerned whether they would, how much they would allow me to say. Of course, there's nothing classified in the book. I just mean about exposing, in essence, the culture. American people would not be happy to see the lackluster performance of people who, as I've hope made very clear, I'm not really referring to the criminal work, but the things that are not brought to trial, such as counterintelligence, which I became a specialist in, and then these other sensitive cases, but they're not investigated, you know, that are not going to go to trial, such as background investigations.
It was clear to me that there's probably a lot of details that you couldn't contain, but you do change the names of people in the book, except for one name, of Robert Hansen. And he's somebody you worked for. And why don't you tell us who Robert Hansen is and why you chose to actually reveal his name and nobody else's?
Well, when I first put the book together and sent it to the Bureau just very quickly, I had everyone's name in it. And my letter back from the FBI insisted that only my name and Robert Hansen's name could be used. So everyone else had to have a pseudonym. So I immediately changed that. The reason the Bureau approved of that was Robert Hansen had been, of course, arrested for espionage and is in prison for the rest of his life sentence in solitary confinement. So that's why I was free to use his name. And I don't want to go too long about this, but when I was first writing the book, I was thinking the book would be more about the aspect following 9/11, the lack of concern of people in counterintelligence, that due diligence day to day to day, which really builds a structure, that day-to-day work is what allows you to be, I think, more ready for an event such as 9/11. So I saw that weakness in working the counterintelligence cases as somewhat responsible. But as far as Robert Hansen, I don't know if you've read anything about him.
I have, but maybe you'll tell our readers and listeners how he has ended up in life in prison.
Okay. Well, Mr. Hansen came into the Bureau in 1976, like myself, as a GS-10 special agent, and he quickly decided to go into management, from what I understand. By 1979, he had already made contact with the Soviets and was working as a double agent. And it's incredible irony that he went from 1979 to 2000 undetected. This, I think, really speaks volumes about the lack of oversight, that the Bureau had no idea this was going on for all that time. And I'm trying to be very careful about the time I was on his squad in New York. I hope that it comes across that the way our squad was managed by him was utterly preposterous. And when I questioned people, what's going on here, they just told me, you do well to keep your mouth shut. So that culture allowed Mr. Hansen to be a double agent for over 20 years. And he was only discovered a few months before his retirement by a Soviet who identified that there was a mole in the Bureau. There was somebody in the Bureau. And that, I think, is also ironic. He nearly made it to retirement, but it wasn't because of the Bureau's skill. It was because we were told by another intelligence service, the Soviets.
You know, when I was reading your book, I couldn't help but be reminded of the television show, The Americans. Mm. And I don't know if you have watched that show, but it is all about this type of thing. And that's where, you know, we look at at fiction, and yet you reveal that elements of this are actually happening, and that Robert Hansen was caught makes me wonder, are there other agents working for the FBI or other intelligence agencies that maybe have not been detected and are working in their own self-interest or against the interests of our country?
I suspected someone else on our squad at the time when I looked back, and he's detailed, you know, the individual that's the person who threatened me, who had carte blanche that I say, you know, he's keeping book on Bob. But I would be concerned to ever go out, you know, and say that I know for sure, because I never encountered anyone. I mean, of course, again, at the time in the 80s, we didn't know, but it certainly was something that I questioned the way the squad was run, because it was very secure. It was an off-site location, and it should have been under very strict protocol. And as I detail in the book, just a handful of the incidents. No one should be running a squad the way he was running it. And I felt that later when I looked back, it really was indicative something was going on. But again, if you speak up, you really get in trouble. You can't step forward. And that's, you know, whistleblowers are drummed out. It's not a good situation. And I don't think it would be any different today.
Well, you tried to get out of that bad situation in New York, and you took other opportunities and ended up in Kansas City, was it?
It was Salt Lake City.
And you also, though, went to language school, and you yourself became a Soviet expert, correct?
Well, the Bureau has a certain way of selecting people to go for foreign language based on testing. And I volunteered for that out of the Houston division just before 1985. So after I completed my studies, that's when I was sent to New York and got on Bob Hansen's squad. And because of my, they needed a group of people to go out to Salt Lake to start a case. But I worked very hard when I got there. And my wonderful SAC out there, who already knew of me back in Kansas City in my first assignment, he just kept insisting I stay on. And I eventually was transferred. So my hard work really did pay off. And I was thrilled to have that opportunity.
Now, you were involved in counterintelligence, and why don't you explain to us what counterintelligence is?
Okay. Well, there are two branches of how we do intelligence work. I think a lot of people are familiar with the CIA, and they do active intelligence, and that would be outside the United States. Counterintelligence works against people doing active intelligence. So let's say, for instance, the Soviet Union. If they are sending people here under different auspices, we are trying to counter the intelligence work that they are attempting to do. That's the most simple way. So they can see, once in a while, of course, the CIA, I worked with a woman on a case back there in Houston. But in general, CIA handles things that are intelligence, foreign soil. The Bureau handles things on the U.S. soil that are countering intelligence officers and activity from foreign nations, foreign countries.
Some of this is probably fairly mundane at times, but other times you were involved in some degree of undercover work. And I'm just wondering, really, how one conducts their lives. How did you conduct your daily life doing undercover work? I mean, it must be, you know, you talk about just being in the FBI is pretty much takes over your identity. But then when you have to assume another identity, what does that do to you?
Thank you for that. It really does. In that sense, I would say, Suzanne, that sometimes the way films depict that is quite accurate. You really become cut off from the organization. When I went into the undercover aspect in Salt Lake City, I could no longer have anything to do with the FBI in an active way, could not call there, could not go there, and you are out in the depths. And so the person who's your contact agent is your only connection to the fact that you're still an FBI agent. It's a very difficult thing to do. I had to quite limit any of my contact with even family, because people come to my home. I have two pocketbooks. I have two vehicles. I have a phone line that's been spliced so that my answering machine back at those days picks up the calls for this person and that person, both being me. So it's very, very difficult. I also, being the kind of person I am, did 100% plus. I just completely went into it. And the honor was, it was a brand new case. Myself and another individual, we were the very first agents working this. So all eyes were on us. It was very sensitive. And by the way, this case is still running. It is still an active case 30 years later. And that's not the only reason I can't mention it, but it's a very, very critical case.
So when a case goes on for 30 years, is it the type of thing that doesn't get solved, it just gets evolved? I mean, how would a case be running for 30 years?
Well, individual cases that are for people, like the work I did in Houston, those cases are assigned, they're open, they're closed very quickly. Those are little questions that pop up about people. But this kind of case that I'm referring to is something that's structured by our government to be a long-term relationship. And I said, I get concerned to say anything that might reveal it. But what we're really trying to do in a case that would go on for years and years is, how do I put this? I used to liken it to, I would talk to my contact agent and say, we're basically waiting for someone to run into our arms, if that mm-hmm. makes sense to you, mm-hmm. if I can use that type of phrase.
So creating a circumstance mm-hmm. where information is revealed over time?
Yes. And, you know, we've had in our history, I've always wondered if I can just say, with the downfall of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, why was Robert Hansen from 91 to 2001 still doing what he was doing? Very interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I thought they were off the list.
Right.
But as you can see, you have the political reality, the economic reality, then you have, we have travel. I readily go to the former Soviet Union all the time. There's no interference in that. But we kind of know that the countries are still operating on that same level as decades ago. That's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think things are complicated right now, politically mm-hmm. complicated right now with our relationship. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your own perceptions or impressions about what's happening politically right now with our relationship with the Soviet Union, which seems, well, I've noticed a lot of people are reverting to calling it the Soviet Union again, but I'll say Russia, mm-hmm. because we seem to have elements of our government that are enforcing sanctions and kind of preserving some of this distance, but yet we have a commander-in-chief who seems to have a different relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russia. And I guess I just am wondering how things that are in the headlines right now, just how you react to them, and if you have any insights that you can share.
The counterintelligence world, my impression is, it's rather like a chess game. And also, at the highest levels, everyone meets. So you have people like myself, we're the pawns on the board. But at the highest level, they always talk. They always have talked. And it's more and more resources that are being spent. And I feel it's misspent effort and money, because there is no attempt to solve anything. They're not trying to solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're just keeping tabs. Mm-hmm. That's really how it is.
I'm talking with Barbara Van Driel, who spent some time in the FBI. And the book does get us comfortable with your, well, comfortable is not the word. You set the setting of your life in the FBI. And I think a lot of it, though, was the your earnestness in going into this career. And the treatment you got as a woman and the sexual harassment that you experienced as well seemed pretty steady throughout your career. Talk a little bit about that. And is that ultimately what pushed you out? And we could maybe talk about that in a minute. But tell us about just that whole thing of you being a woman in a boys' club and how they treated you.
Just quickly, it's not the reason I left, but one of the things that I wanted to make clear that I found very fascinating, prior to my time in the Bureau, I never had an incident of any kind of harassment. Since that time, I think I can count one time when a doctor, when I was in school, a doctor approached me disrespectfully and harassed me. And that's many years now. That's since 1991 to the present. So there was something unique about the kind of men or the kind of environment where they thought that they could do this. It was very shocking to me, Suzanne, very shocking. Never anticipated this. And the other thing that I guess I would like to flesh out here is I didn't have relationships in the sense that there was never a prelude like, I'd like to have a relationship with you, I'm interested in you. Just as I chronicle, they're out of the blue.
Yes, jamming their tongue down your throat or something like that. Yeah,
just out of the blue, with no forewarning. And as a woman, who's now, my birthday's next week, I'm up there. This has not happened to me, whether I've been dating or working in other places. So it was not something I could really understand again at the time, and it was humiliating to me. And the environment was such, people wonder why I didn't talk about it. You just didn't. You didn't talk about it. The 80s are very different from today.
Yeah.
And my attempts, each of them, as you can see, the couple of early things I never mentioned, but once I had someone really put his hands on me and other body parts, I tried to speak up. And you can see early on there in Houston, I was so warned. I was so threatened by the warning. You dare not pursue this. Your career is over if you do. And I'm fully convinced of that. That would have been the case. Absolutely. They did not tolerate going against the status quo.
And did you talk with female colleagues? Did they have the same experience? Or is that something you didn't even talk with other colleagues about?
There were very few women agents. In my entire career, I only worked one time helping another female agent on an interview, and that was in Salt Lake City, when she had a difficult individual and she asked me to come along. One of the things I was very careful about in my book is there is no hearsay. Everything had to happen to me directly for me to write about it. That was my own self-imposed standard. But I do recall in Salt Lake City being approached by a woman who had only been an agent 1 year. She had had an EEO complaint of sexual behavior, sexual harassment. She was a married individual, and she said goodbye to me. I didn't put it in the book because I just did not have enough information. But she was devastated. She had only been a year an agent. And she said, you know, Barb, I won my case and my career is over and I'm leaving today. So by not serving 3 years in the Bureau, that's a black mark against you. If you don't serve 3 years after being hired, you never refer back to your FBI career. It's a negative. So she went out. She was, I guess, awarded some money. She won her case. You couldn't go up against the system. You just couldn't.
Hopefully that environment has changed now. Do you have a sense of that at all? Are there more women in the FBI today? Or have you pretty much, when you left the FBI, you left?
When I left, I left. I didn't try to stay in touch. with people. I do have a contact now who's been out of the Bureau a couple of years, and he tells me better. There are a lot more women, and they're going into management and things, much, much more. What's interesting, Suzanne, is if you talk to an FBI agent, and you're an FBI mm-hmm. agent, the kind of conversation you can have over coffee is completely different than if you were to invite that person as a non-Bureau person to have a conversation about the Bureau. You will not get the truth. We talk very confidentially. So I'm doing something quite daring by being willing to speak up, and I'm hoping I won't have negative blowback, but I suspect that I may.
Well, because you use your real name, you tried to, or you had wanted to leave service with the FBI at one point and were convinced to stay on for a couple of more years. But why did you ultimately decide you needed to get out?
I really, really wanted to make a difference. That was my whole goal. Again, some of the things that I never mentioned. For instance, when I was interviewing, it was about a year and a half, the whole process of getting in. I can tell you honestly, I never asked what the pay was. I didn't care what I was going to earn. I knew it would be, you know, I was coming out of college. It was going to be fine. Never taken a job based on money. And I wasn't interested in status. I really am, you know, it kind of sounds old-fashioned, and I've tried not to toot my own horn, but I really wanted to serve my fellow citizens and serve my government in that sense, which are the fellow citizens. And as I went along and I saw the continual discouragement to work hard, especially since I had chosen to go and I wanted to stay in counterintelligence, I just said, you know, if I look down the road, will I have made a difference? Oh, I get a pension, and, you know, I've known different people. And I can say another thing I decided not to put in the book, but I'll tell you, it's not classified or anything. In the last few months when I was really wrestling with this, I decided to call three agents that I knew my entire career. And I said to them, this is just between us, just confidential. And you know, Suzanne, every one of them said to me, Barbara, if you can flee, run as fast as you can. I wish I could, but I have a family and I have to stay. And that was shocking to me. I respected all three of those men.
Wow.
And they all would have fled if they could have. That's what they told me.
Wow.
So there's a lot of people discouraged, but you join in that bureaucracy, and there's a magic amount of time, I suppose. It was very difficult for me to ever work again, I will tell you that, because people could not believe that I somehow was not still like with the Bureau. I had a lot of skepticism when I wanted to go into a new field. I took many years and didn't work at all. It's impossible to replace being an FBI agent in another career.
And even though you did go on and do some other work that you have found valuable, and mm-hmm. and now this book, and I want to before we close our conversation, again, the name of the book is It Never Happened: FBI Negligence and Duplicity Revealed from the Inside Out. I would like to talk a little bit about, why did you decide now? Maybe has it been 20 years since you've been out, something like that? Mm-hmm. Why did you decide now to write this book? And what was your process? Because as you said, a lot of details maybe had to be scrubbed or somehow rounded out for mm-hmm. maybe security mm-hmm. reasons. But so what was your process and decision making?
Mm-hmm. Actually, Suzanne, I decided to write the book in 2008. That's when I sat down and put the basic book down on paper. And I write by hand. Then I hired someone to put it on a computer. We made inquiry with different people in the world of publishing. No one was interested in my story whatsoever. So I put it on the shelf. And about 5 years ago, I decided to start writing my first novel, which I hope to complete. And it's based on my career with a character that's me, but better, espionage story. But earlier in the year, I have a lovely attorney friend who's in the entertainment world, entertainment attorney, I rang her up. I saw what was happening between the things that you mentioned in the very beginning of our conversation with the Me Too movement.
Yes.
And the counterintelligence questions coming up with the different characters hiding, basically, under that mask. And I asked her, and she said, you must do this. And that's what made me ultimately decide. I have her to thank. I don't know if I would have bothered because I just didn't feel the reception would be there. But I want to make something very clear. I did not write this book to get an attorney, to sue anybody, to pursue anything financially. That's not my motivation. And I do hope that at the end, people see that being successful is not your particular career. I never had a bad day as an FBI agent. I really didn't. I loved every minute of it. Unfortunately, it was the culture. That was the conflict. And I don't intend to pursue any kind of remuneration or anything like that. I just want my story to be out there.
Well, I thank you for joining us today. And something you say, kind of almost a mantra, truth, dignity, and integrity. And you dedicate the book to your dad, and it seems like your dad is the one who put these qualities, truth, dignity, and integrity, into your lexicon. So your dad was a big inspiration to you.
Very much so. And I can say he was my greatest cheerleader, so proud of me, and quite devastated when I left the Bureau. He could not understand it, and I really couldn't tell him. He never knew of any of the sexual predatory behavior. He would have been devastated by that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. My father's passed away, but very, very much with me, and he would be very proud of me to see this book in print.
Well, I hope we also, some point in the future, get to see your novel in print, where maybe you can mm-hmm. be more explicit in a fictional sort of way.
Very much so. Yes, it's really freeing to write a novel. It's more difficult, but it's very freeing because, you know, I always say it's all truth, but it's couched in fiction, right? But mm-hmm. you can tell the truth and you don't have to have the same concerns. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm looking forward to I think, I don't know if I'm a good writer. This is my first endeavor. So I wanted to see, and people think I'm, you know, it's worthwhile to read something I've written.
Like I said, it almost read like fiction sometimes. And I think that in a memoir, that gets our attention.
Well, thank you.
Barbara, is there anything you'd like to leave with our readers and listeners before we say goodbye?
Well, first of all, Suzanne, I want to thank you. I'm very grateful that you reached out to me. And I want the people who might consider reading my book, I want people to be encouraged. I don't want people to take this book and be discouraged. My ultimate goal is that people would realize the strength in living their ethic, no matter what they encounter, to not compromise, to not play the game, but to live true to what you believe. And I think no matter what that is, that is my message, and I hope that that's what people take away from it.
Well, I wish you nothing but the best, and thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so very much. Really appreciate it.
My conversation with former FBI agent Barbara Van Driel, and her book is It Never Happened, FBI Negligence and Duplicity from the Inside Out. Earlier, we spoke with Andrew Schaefer with his Obama-Biden mystery, Hope Never Dies. Thank you, Barbara and Andrew. We've had assistance today from Sean Knight, Mark Prell, and Sean Smith. We are a production of Lit Radio, and you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.